You are listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Welcome to this episode of CEO Perspectives, a signature podcast series by the Conference Board. CEO Perspectives are conversations that take an objective, nonpartisan look at a range of timely topics that matter most to business leaders. To help make sense of these topics and how they'll unfold, we'll sit down with thought leaders and do what we do best at the Conference Board, provide trusted insights for what's ahead. I'm Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board and the host of this podcast series. And today's conversation will focus on multi-stakeholder capitalism. How should CEOs balance the needs and the demands of their multiple constituencies? And what is the role of business in bettering society? I'm so proud today to have with us Ron O'Hanley, the chairman and CEO of State Street, one of the world's largest banks and asset management companies. And Ron is also a trustee of the Conference Board. Ron, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be with you.
So, Ron, State Street, some of our listeners may not be familiar, but State Street is one of the largest banks in the entire world. I mean, you're one of the largest asset holders. And so, as a result, the bank is one of the largest shareholders of almost every publicly traded company. Just give us some background on State Street's role as one of the largest global stakeholders.
Well, Steve, State Street does play a somewhat unique role because when people think of banks, they think of checking accounts and lending money and things like that. And we certainly are a bank in name only in that we take deposits, but our client base is really the world's investors. So global pension funds, mutual fund companies, sovereign wealth funds. We do two things. We manage assets, and I'm going to spend a lot of time with you talking about that. But we also service assets that are managed by others. And what that means is we could be the custodian. In other words, we're providing safekeeping services. We might provide data management for world's investors. We might provide order management systems, technology, front office, back office technology. So as a consequence, everything we do revolves around the investor. In fact, we describe our purpose is to help the world's investors achieve better outcomes for themselves and the people they serve. As a consequence of that focus, we are a very large manager of capital. Depending on who's counting, we're either the third largest or the fourth largest in the world. And much of that is index-related assets, meaning that these are companies that remain in our portfolio as long as they remain in the index. So it's an important role. It's one we take very seriously. And it's one that puts us in the position of either making decisions on investments or helping other institutions make decisions on investments. So we take it very seriously.
Yeah, and this whole notion of index funds versus actively managed capital is an important distinction. So, I'm sure you have some actively managed, but what's the rough proportion of index to active?
Yeah, in terms of assets, roughly $3.6 trillion and probably 80% of that is in some form of an index.
Yeah.
Now, the indices themselves could be actively managed in terms of asset allocation, but a very large proportion is in index. And the reason why that's so important and guides much of the way we operate and behave is because if a company is in an index, we as a portfolio manager don't have the customary, gee, if I don't like what you're doing, I'm going to sell you. So it's largely permanent capital in the public markets. In some respects, that's actually very attractive to companies because they know that that capital will be there, that that shareholder that's chosen to invest that way will be around for a long time. At the same time, it forces shareholders to actually take a different or to use different tactics in terms of how they're going to try and influence portfolio companies.
Yeah, and you made an important distinction in there. I, as a CEO of several companies, we used to talk about this with our investors and say, here's what we're doing, and if you don't like what we're doing, you can always you can always buy and sell. But that isn't the case with so-called permanent capital, which is the way to think about indexing, because you essentially are buying to match, you know, the Fortune 500 index or the Russell 3000, you know, whatever the appropriate index is. And therefore, you know, even though there might be some mix and match to level off at the end of a quarter or something, it really is permanent capital. And you know, we're starting to see that for the Fortune 500 or the Fortune 1000, even that roughly a third of their investors is so-called permanent capital, right?
Yeah, that's right. And as more and more investors, whether they're institutions or individuals, have decided to invest using indexes, that has translated into a higher and higher percentage of a company being owned by an index fund on behalf of those investors. I think that's in many ways beneficial to companies, because I go back to the fact that it's permanent capital, right? It's very long-term in nature. And it shouldn't be confused. The word passive is a terrible term. And it shouldn't be confused with the notion that the shareholders themselves are passive, because, and you've certainly seen a lot of this over the last 5 to 10 years, the index managers, and by the way, the clients who employ index managers are very keen to make sure that they do exercise their rights. Their rights are very different. Again, it's not about divestment, it's about engagement, it's about stewardship. And to the extent to which you're unhappy, you express that unhappiness, not through divestment, but typically by the way you vote, whether you're voting for the board, whether you're going to vote for individual board members, et cetera.
Yeah, and through the engagement with that companies. You know, as a CEO, I always wanted to have, you know, more index funds and permanent capital, because then I could focus on the long-term running of the company rather than worrying about, you know, when somebody wanted to buy or to sell and the whole trading aspect of it, which I think, you know, leads to short-termism, obviously in the markets, but also in terms of how managers run companies. So it's actually, I think, better for our country and for the markets to have the, you know, a longer-term perspective.
I think that's right. And I think as the you know, the other large index managers would be BlackRock and Vanguard outside of the United States, Legal in general, as those managers have grown, I know there's been some concerns expressed by, do these managers have too much power? Well, I mean, as we talked about, they really don't have the ultimate power, which is to divest. And I actually think it provides a healthy perspective, because at the other extreme, right, you've got the quantitative or the so-called high frequency traders, right, that maybe have a holding period of minutes or hours. So there's that perspective there, and reacting typically to headline news and things like that. These index managers are very long-term, right? What they're thinking about and working with, engaging with companies on is how are you thinking about your long-term strategy? How are you thinking about the way you're governing the place? And how can we be sure that governance will be good, not just for the next year, but for the next 10 years? So it's instilled a healthy, I think, kind of intersection and dialogue between the long-term shareholders and the short-term shareholders.
It really has. And, you know, it also has changed the dynamics and the focus of business leaders. You know, for decades, you know, maybe even the past century, the focus has been on shareholder primacy, meaning the focus was on delivering shareholder results quarter to quarter to quarter without regard to much else. And I think now, given this rise and power, if you will, with State Street and others that you mentioned, the focus has shifted to a multi-constituent model, including, you know, customers, employees, certainly the shareholder, but community and environment as well. So talk about how you see the balance in shareholder value creation, as well as the balance of these other constituencies.
Yeah, and there's a debate in many quarters about this now, Steve, but I view this as a long-term evolution, right? If you go back 100 years ago, 125 years ago, corporations didn't worry much about employee safety. You know, if a customer died while using the product, kind of didn't matter, right? And we would never think about questioning that now, that you need to be worried about your employees' safety and your products need to be safe and you got to keep your customers safe. And I think what's happened over time, particularly as you've got this cadre of shareholders that are very much focused on the long term, that over the fullness of time, lots of things matter, right? So maybe in a quarter, how you treat your employees or whether or not you've got, you know, whether you've not got a good climate plan, maybe that doesn't matter over the short term. Over the long term, it does. And again, these shareholders really do have to think about what are the risks over the long term. And I think about this as risk. So, you know, you start to get into this debate around, are you imposing your values? And I always say, listen, I've got a set of values, but that's not for me to impose on others or even to make an investment decision on behalf of others. It's about value. And over the long term, things like your impact on a community, where you're drawing your labor from, whether or not you're well positioned for a climate change. And we could debate on whether or not how much climate change is going to matter for a particular company, but that's the definition of risk. More things can happen than will happen. And that's what managers and boards are meant to do. So I think that, you know, this is viewed as some kind of revolutionary thing. I view it as evolutionary, and it's healthy for long-term investors to be thinking that way. The other thing I would add in all this that we keep forgetting is most investors themselves are long-term. And by that, I mean, if you're a pension fund, if you're an open pension fund, it'll be about 75 years by the time you write your last check. If you're a sovereign wealth fund, you're thinking about how do I create value for the next generation? So these are long-term liabilities and you need a long-term set of assets to put against them.
Yeah, you know, famous economist Milton Friedman is often blamed for this shareholder primacy. But if you read, you know, his writings and what he was talking about, what he was saying is, if you focus on producing results, you by de facto will have to take care of your customers. You'll have to take care of your employees and so forth. So his point was, if you focus on delivering returns, you can't do that in a vacuum. You have to take all the other things into account. But anyway, that his words have been distorted into, you know, you focus only on shareholder value. But I think this, as a CEO, I always found that you had to balance it all, right? Because, you know, if you only produce shareholder value and that was strictly all that you dealt with, well, then you wouldn't pay, you know, your employees. You know, you try to shift, you know, the pay to profits, and, you know, you would cut corners with your customers. Well, that wouldn't last very long. So, you know, there's a lot of common sense that has to, you know, you just have to think about here, because it all has to be sort of in harmony in order to optimize it for the long run. And I that's what I hear you saying.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that CEOs do have to balance lots of things, but, you know, that's basically in the job description. I mean, that's what a successful CEO is always about. And I'd be the last to say that quarters don't matter. I think it actually is important to be measuring yourself periodically and see if you're making progress. But one should, I believe, talk about the quarter in the context of what are you trying to achieve? And what you're trying to achieve may, in fact, be a long-term turnaround. It may be the addition of a product line that wasn't there. And so, you know, timeframes can matter. But what one does is, I think ideally, is take those quarterly results and put them in the context of what you've said you're trying to achieve. The other thing that's important here, too, is that boards, I think, are an important balancing act to this. Because, as you know, Steve, as you well know, you've seen this. I think the conference board has even talked about this. You know, the tenure of CEOs, the average tenure has gone down dramatically over the last 10, 15 years. I think it's actually 5 years, but in the U.S., that's not long-term to me. That's pretty short. That's at least medium-term. And so boards provide a longer-term perspective. In the typical board, first of all, boards don't go in and out at once. You know, you have boards that are overlapping, and they can provide some of that long-term perspective. And if you will, keeping the firm and keeping management on the long-term journey.
Yeah, so far we've talked about how to balance the competing demands of shareholders and now the broader swath of stakeholders. But what's the role of a corporation in society? We're going to take a look at this after a short break, and we'll be right back.
Interested in this content? You can find this and much more at our Conference Board website, www.conference-board.org. Or even better, contact our membership team and your company can enjoy the benefits of our in-depth research around the economy, environmental, social, and governance issues, public policy, marketing and communications, and human capital. As a member of the Conference Board, you will be able to have full access to all of our cutting-edge research, leading indicators, benchmarking and data services, in addition to webcasts and podcasts such as the one you are enjoying now.
Welcome back to CEO Perspectives. I'm your host, Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board, and I'm joined today by Ron O'Hanley, the chairman and CEO of State Street. So Ron, State Street as so-called permanent capital is of course focused on shareholder returns, but given this broad focus on multi-stakeholders, what kind of responsibilities do you see that State Street has that maybe more active shareholders don't? For instance, in the ESG world.
So I think because of the role we play in the investment community, either as a manager of assets or as a servicer, custodian, and administrator of assets, we do feel like we play a special role. We've talked about in terms of our managing of assets, the stewardship and engagement that we do with our portfolio companies. We also believe that because the investors are all struggling with how to do this right, that we have to be there in terms of products, ideas, in terms of how do the investors think about whether it's managing against ESG, managing against some climate objective, yet at the same time delivering appropriate shareholder returns. I think that's also, we have felt for a long time that if you're going to be talking about these issues, such as good governance, we have to be a poster child for it. So our board, which is I think is a terrific board, a very strong set of independent individuals, we've worked very hard to build in diversity there, to build in, the kinds of skills that are required to not just operate in our markets and around our businesses and products, but in the larger ecosystem in which we operate. I mean, we're one of the so-called globally systemically important financial institutions, right? So regulators are worried about those firms and how they operate. How do they create a systemic stability and not create instability? So our view on this is that we need to be a role model in all of this.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was a CEO of several companies, I spent most of my time with portfolio managers who were deciding whether to buy or sell, the name, the stock. Now as a board member, I'm spending my time talking to shareholders, but it's the governance people. Yes. in the companies. And the conversation is remarkably different. You get into what are the thoughts of the company and what are the strategies of the company around, carbon and around water and around, sustainable, depending on what the industry is, sustainable growth. It is more of a broad societal long-term focus, I think, than strictly, what's happening with the finances of the company. How do you find State Street interacting with portfolio companies in this balance? Is it mostly the latter?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Steve. And I think it's evolving. I think in the early days, and let's just use ESG as the frame here, the early focus was mostly on G, governance. And, you'd have the so-called governance people that would come in. Typically, it was with a separate meeting with the company. Sometimes it wouldn't even be with the CEO or the CFO. It would be with a board member, whether it was the chairman, lead director, et cetera. I think that's evolving and it's rapidly moving towards one meeting where it's, you've got the hardcore, active portfolio managers, but you've also got the specialists in there that know something about governance, know something about climate. And you're seeing And I think this is the result of most firms moving away from, and I'm talking about investment firms, moving away from, well, I have to do this because my clients are telling me to. They're really integrating it into their investment risk framework and, you know, even how they invest, which I think is a healthy move to see that becoming becoming one.
Well, and now you're seeing this great rise in so-called ESG funds, you know, and there are indices around ESG funds. In other words, funds that invest only in companies that they view as being, you know, positive, having positive strategies towards ESG. Talk about State Street's strategy with ESG funds.
Before I answer that, I will note that I just saw that over the last couple of days that a new ETF was launched called BAD, which is the exact opposite. It's about alcohol and firearms and tobacco and all the other things that. So we'll see. We'll see where that one goes. you have seen this rise, and I think on the one hand, I think it's an expression of investor desire. I worry a little bit that there's some. And I think regulators worry that there's, you know, a lot of marketing and not a lot of substance in all this. Listen, I think that the evidence is showing that good companies that perform well against ESG metrics are actually outperforming. Now, we don't have long data on this, but we're getting longer and longer data. But certainly, if you think about the diversity element of this, there's several Harvard, McKinsey have done studies on diversity of firms, both in the management ranks and in the boards. And whether it's gender, racial diversity, more diversity typically is a marker towards better long-term performance. Similarly, what we've seen over the last, there was a study again coming out of Harvard that looked at what's the performance of high carbon content versus low carbon content companies. And what they did was they actually, we provided the data to them. So we took our custodial data from 2019 to, I think the study ended around September. So it's, you know, about a little over almost 2 years worth of data. And first of all, it showed that the carbon content of the weighted average market is down by 30%. Which is an extraordinary number. And that really, but then the team dug at it. Half of that, a little over half of that, is asset repricing, meaning investors decided they're going to pay more for a low carbon company than a high carbon company. And then, but the second part, the kind of 40% of it is companies actually lowered their carbon content or their carbon emissions. And so I think the point here is investors are interested in this, and therefore, money management firms are selling these products. The caveat here is, you know, the measurement is far from mature. All right, we're doing as much as anybody on this, and we'd be the first to say it's far from mature. So what I worry about is that there'll be, whether it's a scandal or, you know, we're going to find that we're not, many of us are not doing this right. So lots of work underway to really get at the analytics and the data around this so that individual investors can make informed choices, portfolio managers can make informed choices. But there's no question, whether it's institutions and even individual investors, this is how they want to invest. I mean, and they're investing, not everybody, and they're not saying, I don't care about return, but I care about return. And I also care about how I get that return.
Yeah, and you know, this whole there are several studies, you know, to which you referred that show a correlation between companies that are focused on ESG and also their performance. You wonder how much of it's causal. That's hard to tease out of the data, and whether it's just the best companies just also are their best at everything. I mean, they're just doing really well, and so, you know, they're great at diversity and great at other things. And in a bull market, you know, when everything is going well, it does give the board and management more latitude to focus on other issues, you know, that are higher up on Maslow's hierarchy. And the question will be, you know, when we get into more difficult times, what really happens, you know, to their focus on all of this? But that kind of brings you around to, you know, the purpose of the corporation. And, you know, you and I have talked about this in the past. And I've had conversations with members of Congress who say, well, you know, these are public companies, and so therefore they should be thought of as more like the public sector. when in fact they're not. They're in the private sector, and there seems, you know, sometimes I wonder whether there's deliberate confusion or just accidental confusion over that. But how should, you know, how should, first of all, investors, but also how should management teams and boards be thinking about their companies and their role in society?
Yeah, and I go back to Steve in thinking about the answer to that question of time frame. And I think most management teams and most corporations aspire to be around for a long time. So as a result of that, I think you do have to open your lens. And the realities are is that, you know, most corporations have been doing this without being told. I mean, if you think about the impact and go to any city in the United States and, you know, who are some of the major benefactors of the community, who's driving some of the, you know, whether it's school reform, whether it's, you know, volunteerism, whether it's as simple as, you know, supporting the local strategies, it's the local charities, it's often the corporation. And I do believe that, again, we don't have to get into a discussion on values, that it makes sense for long-term value. I mean, who wants to be in a community that's decaying around them? How are you going to attract employees to a place that nobody wants to live? So I think that the corporation, it is a profit-making and profit-seeking entity. And its fiduciary duty is to its shareholders, and it's to create long-term value. And so this is not to say that the importance of making profits and growing revenues shouldn't be paramount. But again, in over time frames, other things are too, to ensure that one still has the right to do that and the ability to do that. So I think this is a false debate that gets put in place, and that both can be true.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what Milton Friedman said, if you go beyond the clip. Last question, Ron, you know, where is ESG going for companies? What, you know, what does Nirvana really look like, and how will we know when we're there?
So, and I spent 4 days at COP26, and I've been doing, our firm has been doing a fair amount of work in climate because we're investors, right, in all these various companies. And so much of what I'm about to say will come, you know, a little bit of reflecting coming back from COP. One is, I think we've achieved the tipping point here, meaning I don't think any corporation is saying that stuff doesn't matter. They may be saying, I don't like it. You know, I wish I didn't have to deal with this. And sure, I'd rather have one thing to think about than 10. I mean, that's human nature. But I think that for the most part, corporations are at the point of not debating it, but okay, what are the objectives? What are the rules under which we're going to operate, and how are we going to be measured? And lastly, this needs to be consistent, particularly if one's a global company. So I think that that's where the work and the debate is on, which is very, very healthy, because, you know, rather than get into a debate on, you know, should it be 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees around climate, or, you know, does X contribute to it or not? It's a little bit of, let's just assume that we've got to get there. How are we going to get there? So you'll see a lot of focus, and there is a lot of focus on common measurement schemes. What people didn't pick up on as much coming out of COP was the agreement of the US and China to basically abide by the climate-related kinds of measurements that were coming out of the IFRS, basically it's the accounting scheme that governs not the US, but everybody else in the world. That's actually a huge move, because that means that, in effect, GAAP is saying to the rest of the world, okay, we'll follow you on this and be consistent. So that helps if you're a State Street or any other global company. And by the way, most companies these days are global or aspire to be global. So you'll start to see consistency of standards. There'll be with more data being collected, we'll see what data is good and we'll see what data is bad. So I think you'll start to see metrics getting better over time. So I'm actually optimistic about this. I mean, the big thing that's standing in the way as it relates to climate is that, you know, we don't have a world market for carbon pricing. And I'm a firm believer that if we've talked about Milton Friedman a lot, that if Milton Friedman were here, he'd be pounding the table for carbon pricing, because he'd say it's the ultimate externality, right? And it's a cost that corporations can't and shouldn't be foisting on the public. They need to take it in. We're not there yet. So that therefore is going to make it a little bit harder to do what we need to do, but I think we're on a good path.
Well, all economists believe in markets, and so you have to believe that that market will come as well. Ron O'Hanley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Steve, it was great to be with you. Thanks very much.
And thanks to all of you for listening in to CEO Perspectives. Every few weeks, I'll be joined by a prominent thought leader to provide insights on the issues of our time. We'll cover the leading topics in economics, public policy, ESG, human capital, and more. Please share CEO Perspectives with your colleagues, with your friends, with your neighbors, with your grandchildren. Well, maybe not to grandchildren, but I know everybody else will want to listen. I'm Steve Odlin, and this podcast has been brought to you by the Conference Board.
You have been listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.